the properties of ground states of one-dimensional systems with a gap, with a gap Hamiltonian. On the other hand, we saw the meta, and we argued again that this time the connectivity of the tensors, these tensors are connected in two dimensions with the additional dimension corresponding to scale. And just because of this way, just because of the way we connected the tensors, we argued that the two-point correlators are going to asymptotically decay as a power law, and that the entanglement entropy is upper bounded by the log, a logarithmic growth with the size of the region. And that is, again, a match with the properties of ground states of gapless Hamiltonians. Very good. And just so that I'm not misleading you, I want to insist that in practice, you can use a matrix product state, this structure, to study critical systems. Or you can use the meta to study gap systems. Okay? What I was telling you here is the asymptotics, how at long distances the correlations will decay. But you can study, you can approximate. So this result here actually follows from the fact that we have this transfer matrix, which tells us that the two-point correlators are going to be given by a sum of exponentials. Okay? But the sum of exponentials for short distances can approximate whatever you want. Okay? So at short distances, you might be able to use a matrix product state to approximate a power law decay. For long distances, eventually, you'll see that there is an exponential decay. But at short distances, you can still extract local information for critical systems. So matrix product states, in practice, are used to look at properties of critical systems. Of course, the point of this discussion here was to say that the meta is it's naturally prepared to describe such systems, and as such, we'll see that we can get very high precision in observables or in say the critical exponents of the theory. Very good. Are there questions about this? So if there are no questions, then I'll continue with what I was saying yesterday. Yesterday, I started visualizing, or I wanted us to have a look at this meta from different perspectives. The first one was to interpret it as a quantum circuit. And the point of doing that is that it gives you a nice picture of what the wave function down here is going to be. The wave function, the variational wave function, can be understood as the result of starting with a product state. So you have your n spins in a product state, no entanglement at all. And then you can understand the final state, this one here, as the result of applying a quantum circuit, as given by all these gates, to this initial state. And what this quantum circuit is doing for you is that it introduces entanglement at the system in an organized way, starting from large length scales. So this tensor here will introduce entanglement that will be seen throughout the system. And then going down to a smaller length scale, say this tensor here will introduce entanglement. This gate will introduce entanglement that will only be seen in a neighborhood. Okay. In this case, we are going to assume, for simplicity, that they are two, dimension two, spin 1/2. Obviously, in practice, you can play around with that. But for this explanation, it's easier to think that they are dimension two. No, what you could think is that everything is dimension 8, and then it's like here represents 3 spins instead of 1. So you could do something like that. Very good. And then the other way of trying to understand what meta is about is to think that it's a coherent transformation, and the point I was trying to make yesterday is that previous coherent transformations would consist in blocking spins, put two spins into one. And if you do that, you realize that you are treating in different way short-range entanglement, depending on whether this short-range entanglement is sitting between or is entangling spins that are going to coherent into the same spin or spins that are going to coherent into different spins. In the second case, this short-range entanglement cannot be removed from the system, and it will be promoted to longer-range entanglement, and that's against the spirit of the renormalization group. What you really would like to do is to get rid of all these microscopic details that are not relevant at long distances. And then this is precisely the point of putting these entanglers here, which will allow us to remove such short-range entanglement. And then we also saw that you can think, relatedly, you can think of the meta not as giving you a ground state or a wave function, but actually a sequence of wave functions. It's defining this tensor network gives you a wave function for at the level of the original lattice, but also for each coarse-grained lattice, and that you obtain by coarse-graining the original one by applying this coarse-graining transformation. So you get the idea, you end up with a sequence of wave functions, and those you can use to define a renormalization group flow in the space of wave functions. Okay, so you can think of this as the space of wave functions, and then this coarse-graining transformation will, if you started here, you have a wave function here, it will coarse-grain it into some other wave function, and this defines a flow, an RG flow in the space of wave functions. But if you want to stick to the more traditional view of or practice of thinking about a renormalization group flow in the space of Hamiltonians, you can also have that. And we saw how this works. We saw that if we have that this coarse-grain transformation is such that a local operator, say acting on three sides, under coarse-graining, which we obtain by applying the coarse-grain transformation, and it's a joint conjugate, that using the simplifications of the tensors, what we saw is that indeed the result of coarse-graining a three-side operator is a new three-side operator. Okay, so that means under this coarse-graining transformation, local operators are mapped into local operators. And therefore, if you have your Hamiltonian, which is a sum of local operators, it's mapped also into a sum of local operators by linearity. Okay? And so what we see is that indeed, this allows us to define an RG flow also in the space of Hamiltonians, as we are more familiar with. Question? Oh. Right, I was asked to, well, Pedro, do you want to give microphones when they ask questions? Sorry? Right, but then I would have to be able to do that. Okay, so can you take the microphone, please?
In which your RG is flowing. So you optimize those tensors for a particular Hamiltonian, and then every RG step shouldn't take me from one Hamiltonian to the other. So it shouldn't really flow. So I assume you have to deform the RG step.
Why do you say that each RG step should not change the Hamiltonian?
So if your H is some critical system, at every step it should give you back the same Hamiltonian just rescaled.
But that's exactly what's going to happen if you are at the critical point, right? So, or the fixed point.
So does the Hamiltonian not stay at the same
point?
No.
Okay, I see. So it turns out that the coarse-graining transformation itself depends on where you are in the space of Hamiltonians. So if you give me a fixed point Hamiltonian, the coarse-graining is going to map it into itself. If you give me another Hamiltonian, I'll have to change the coarse-graining. I'll have to reoptimize all the tensors. And then I'll get, so it's a highly nonlinear problem, right? Because the coarse-graining transformation that I'm going to use to coarse-grain a Hamiltonian depends on the Hamiltonian itself. But I think I want to keep the discussion at a higher level and just say, look, this coarse-graining transformation, structurally, we are not asking what's inside the tensors, just by the way the tensor network has been formed. You have a coarse-graining transformation, which you may like or may not, but it's mapping local operators into local operators, right? What will decide whether this is a proper RG flow is whether you have optimized the tensors properly, right? But regardless of that, what the point I'm trying to make is that you have that this coarse-graining transformation maps local operators into local operators, and that's prior even to optimization.
Reoptimize tensors at every step, or you start with some coarse-graining transformation and then keep applying to see if you end up at.
I got that picture with PowerPoint, but yes, that would happen. I mean, that's we would have a discrete flow, not a continuous one, because we have discrete changes of scale. Okay, and so you would see that there are dots instead of straight lines here. And yes, you would have to optimize for a given Hamiltonian. You would have to find the meta that represents its ground state. Then you would constrain the Hamiltonian by this layer, and so on. Okay. Good. So this was all theoretical, and it's a good time to tell you or to give you an idea of what type of accuracies or what happens when you apply this scheme in practice. And to do that, let me summarize by saying, in this case, what we will have is I want to relate meta to CFTs. I want to see to what extent the meta gives you a good approximation to, say, the ground state of a CFT. And so the algorithm is going to take as an input just the a one-dimensional quantum Hamiltonian. So you have a one-dimensional system. You give me the Hamiltonian on the lattice, okay? And let's assume that it's at the critical point. I'm taking a critical Hamiltonian on the lattice as an input. And the output is, after you optimize the meta and you use it to extract information, you can, for instance, extract the conformal data of the underlying CFT, assuming that there was a CFT, of course. So in particular, you can compute the central charge, you can compute the scaling dimensions and conformal spins of the scaling operators, at least with the primaries and first descendants. And then you can also compute the operator product expansion coefficients. So those of you who are familiar with CFT, you would quickly identify that that's a complete specification of the CFT. And so to give you an example, let's just take the criticalizing model. And what we find is the ability first to identify these scaling operators. And that has to do with what I said before. Here, what this is defining is an operator acting on the cosine lattice in terms of an operator acting on the original lattice. Okay? So this is a linear map. This tensor define a linear map that implements a change of a scale. You have a local operator, okay, at some length of scale, and this linear map gives you an operator on a larger length of scale. And so it turns out that then what you can do is you can take this linear map, which implements the change of scale, and you can diagonalize it. Okay? If you diagonalize it, the eigenvectors of this linear map will correspond to the scaling operators of the theory, and the eigenvalues will give you the scaling dimensions. And so that's how we get all this information. And for instance, for the Ising model, we get, say, the density scaling operator is there by construction. This follows from the, it's always given exactly by the method. But then we get descendants of it. We get also the scaling dimensions, 1/8 of the spin operator and the energy density. So these are the three primaries, local primaries of the Ising model. And then also a few of the descendants. And if you worry about accuracy, we get that this should be 1/8. And so 1, 2, 5. And we get a few digits correctly. This should be a 1. So you see that we also get 4 or 5 digits correctly, and so on. And we also can get the scaling operators, which are non-local, but corresponding to the fermions or disorder in the system. And again, the same type of accuracies in the scaling dimensions. That's an example. But then once we have identified on the lattice these scaling operators, which are the eigenvectors of this linear map, we can ask what happens when they fuse. Okay, so we can look at these two scaling operators, and we can see how they fuse into another scaling operator under cosgraining. And so in this way, we can identify the operator product expansion coefficients. And again, we can get the exact solutions with a few digits of accuracy. Okay, so this is to illustrate that this tensor network indeed gives you a very accurate approximation to the ground state of a CFT. These numbers here, these numbers are much harder to extract than, say, the ground state energy. These numbers tell you how the correlations decay at long distances. So if in a numerical simulation, if you try to get this information, say, using a matrix product state, you may not even know how to get this information in the first place. And after a lot of work, you will get maybe 1 or 2 digits of accuracy, not 5 or 6. Okay? Good. So we're happy. We know that the matter can approximate properly the ground state of a CFT. And then the next question is one that might be quite relevant to this school, which is, how is matter related to holography? OK? And the first answer is, let's draw some pictures. Well, I don't need to tell you what holography is after yesterday's lecture. But what I want to do is to relate. So what we want to see is that the matter, in some sense, is indeed realizing in a discrete way some form of holographic description or holographic duality. And so the idea here is, I can take this tensor network or a variation of it and draw it like that, where the boundary here now is the boundary is this circle. And as you go up in scale, you just go up in this into the middle. Okay? It's not exactly the same. There is a change on the top, but these are cosmetics. Very good. So what you want to think of this is, remember that for the CFT in 1 plus 1 dimensions, the gravity dual would be ADS in 2 plus 1. And so the first thing we are going to do is we're going to ignore time. Because we're talking about the ground state, there is no time dependence at all. That's OK. The ground state does not change in time. And so what we want to be thinking is that the CFT lives in this circle here. And that's exactly the open legs of the tensor network. The ground state of the CFT, sorry, is described by a spin chain that lives here, okay? And that the tensor network is going into the bulk of ADS, okay? Tensor network is going in, filling the circle, okay? So that's just visual, but then there are a couple of other facts that we can have a look at to see that indeed there seems to be more than just a drawing. For instance, when we compute the entanglement entropy in the matter, when we studied this upper bound, we were asking what's the minimal number of indices that we have to cut in order to split the tensor network into two pieces, one containing the region of interest and the rest, right? So there will be some number of legs that we had to cut. But this is parallel to the area of minimal surface in the Ryu Takayanagi prescription in ADS-CFT, where you try to see this minimal, this area of minimal, the area of the minimal surface that will split your boundary. So you know, these were two developments that took place in parallel. Meta is not designed to study a gravity theory, but there are similarities in the way that we operate when we compute, say, the entanglement entropy. And similarly, when we discussed the two-point correlators in the meta, what we said is, well, there is this linear map that needs to be applied log L times. Well, actually, this, again, it has to do with the fact that somehow we can interpret all this calculation as having a distance, sorry, as the two-point correlator between these two points being exponential in the distance, but not in the distance, in the physical distance on the spin chain, but in a distance in an emergent, in a hyperbolic geometry that is described by the tensor network. So the distance from here to here, okay, is log L, and the power law follows from having exponential of log L. Okay? So again, we can interpret our calculation of two-point correlations as being given by some geodesic distance in this hyperbolic geometry. Good. So then the story is that Meta was studied in the context of condensed matter and had a few years of peaceful existence until Brian Swingle in 2009 decided to point out that actually there was all these similarities between Meta and ADS-CFT. And since then, there have been a number of developments that I'm not going to review carefully here. But just let me mention that this discrete version, this meta for lattice systems, have been generalized from the discrete to the continuum. And so we have this continuous meta, which might be closer to realizing holography, in the sense that you don't need to add this discretization. And then since then, people like Ryu and Takayanagi themselves have been using this continuous meta. There have been also work by Juan on well, using the meta to study time evolution and black holes, the interior of black holes, and there have been a number of other contributions, which I'm just, you have it, you'll have a copy of this, so you, if you are interested, you can have a look at this work. And maybe one that I want to highlight is this more recent work by Bartek Cseh and collaborators, where they are pointing out that maybe we should not be thinking of meta as realizing hyperbolic space, as a discretization of hyperbolic space, but as something else. And so let me mention this in more detail. I think it's perhaps one of the simplest, or it's something that can be communicated easily, and it makes sense in this school. So remember, the meta is a tensor network, the way we connect the tensors, plus a constraint on the tensors. These tensors, when you take U and U daga, they become the identity, right? So we should not forget that this is part of the definition of the variational class, these isometric constraints. And so what we can do is we can draw the tensor network and say, hey, this looks like hyperbolic plane in the sense that two points down here are connected through a path that, if this is distance L, actually it's log L only. So that's that looks like the hyperbolic plane, and that's what Brian Swingle pointed out. But then that would be just looking at the first part, looking at this as a tensor network where we connect tensors in a given way. But if we go back to remember that there are isometric or unitary constraints on these tensors, and that's what I mean by this, U, U daga identity, W, W daga is equal to the identity, then it turns out that this naturally endows this tensor network with additional structure. It's a as if you have you have a causal structure, which turns this into the Sitter space. Okay, so you could think of the meta as also lattice version of the Sitter space, and so this causal structure, which is essential, was introduced just to be able to compute efficiently with this tensor network, okay, can now be interpreted from this perspective, at least in the holographic setting. And all that is saying is that there are these causal cones in the network that say that if you have a region down here, say these spins, if you want to study the reduced density metrics on these spins, you don't need to know the content of these tensors. You only need to know the content of some tensors that are inside some causal cone. Okay? So there is some Lorentzian causal structure there. Very good. So then what is meta? Is meta equal to holography or ADS-CFT? Clearly, it was not proposed in this sense. And so what we can say for sure is that meta is the realization of these RG ideas, Wilson renormalization group ideas, in real space. And so what we see, though, is that this naturally leads to a tensor network for ground states and Hilbert space. Ground states, or also you can generalize it to represent the Hilbert space of a CFT, which is organized in an extra dimension corresponding to scale. Okay, so that's what we have. Nothing more, nothing less. And in particular, meta represents a generic CFT. It's not asking for large N. It's not assuming or large central charge. It's not assuming strong interactions. It's not assuming anything. We have been using it for the Ising model, which is central charge equal to 1/2, and it's a free theory. Okay. Now, if we want to emulate ADS-CFT, we can also build a dictionary. And this dictionary should be familiar, but I insist that this is not ADS-CFT. This is just what we have with the meta. We can think of the boundary of the meta having the ground state of a CFT. Okay. Do you? If you want to get a good approximation, yes, but that's an approximation scheme, right? Right, but so you can say that there is some large chi there if you want, but that doesn't change the fact that it applies to any CFT, which is the only thing I want to stress here. Okay, so then what I'm saying is we can think of a dictionary here, and for instance, at the boundary we have the state of a CFT or the full Hilbert space. we have scaling dimensions for the local operators on the CFT. Sorry, so let me translate. So this, at the boundary we have the CFT, and in the ball we have what? Well, the tensor network, nothing more, nothing less. So you have these tensors connected in this additional dimension. At the boundary you have the scaling dimensions, and then you can see explicitly that these scaling dimensions translate into exponential decay of correlations in the bulk, in the scale direction. And so that's as saying that there are, that whatever this tensor network is representing in the bulk, there are masses that are related to the scaling dimensions at the boundary. The entanglement entropy at the boundary indeed corresponds to minimal connecting surfaces in the bulk, okay? And then we've also seen that the global on-site, if you have, say, in the Ising model, a Z2 symmetry, you know, remember that the Ising model has this spin flip symmetry, okay? So if you try to represent the Ising model, that translates into these tensors having a Z2 local or gauge symmetry, okay? So a global symmetry at the boundary turns into a gauge symmetry in the bulk. This, remember, right, okay, sorry, good question. So the question is, if this is a fixed time, right, where is this Lorentzian, where is the causal structure coming from? Remember that this causal structure has nothing to do with the real time in the system. It's some auxiliary time that we introduce when we view this as a quantum computation, okay? So there is some auxiliary time attached to the scale direction. But this is not the real time in the CFT. We are talking always about fixed properties here. We have not even tried, at least at this level, the level of this lecture, we have not discussed time dependence, time evolution at all. Okay? So indeed, this causal structure has to do with an auxiliary time, which is not the physical time. Thanks. Okay, so you see, these are elements that you also see, or this dictionary is similar to what you see in ADS CFT. Typical comment on the meta is that, oh, it only operates at the scale of ADS radius, so you cannot see locality beyond that. And yeah, fair enough, this discretization is such that doesn't matter how hard you try, you end up having that the distance between tensors would correspond or is on the order of the ADS radius. Okay, but the answer is, well, if you want to go beyond that, if you would like to resolve the bulk at a smaller scale, then just consider the continuous meta where such limitation is not there. And then what is this? So in the end, you can take this in different ways. The way I like to think about it is a useful testing ground for your ideas. There are nice drawings, and that's maybe a joke, but actually, being able to draw things gives you some intuition sometimes. So, you know, people like being able to have a toy model with which to play a little bit. And then maybe more seriously, it might be pointing at some generalized notion of holography. We can, I mean, it in the end, it's a matter of what do you want to call holographic description. Clearly here we're using an extra dimension to describe in a simpler way the ground state of the CFT. And so maybe this can be done systematically, and it's worth exploring this generalized notion of holography. Very good. So what? Right. So the concrete, the precise statement is that if you want to enforce a global symmetry at the boundary, and you want to do that exactly, you have to resort to enforcing it on each tensor individually. And otherwise it would be a global constraint on the tensor network, but locally when you look at the tensor, you don't know how to impose a global constraint on just the piece. The only way we know how to impose this global constraint, the only way we know how to exactly enforce that the wave function that we are describing is invariant under Z2 and the spin flip, is if we demand each tensor to have proper behavior under a spin flip transformations. And that is computationally, that's by need. This is the way we know how to do this. And then when you want to interpret what you've created, is actually you notice that your meta has this, in the bulk, has the Z2 symmetry implemented locally. If you optimize properly, the most accurate way of doing this seems to be enforcing this symmetry. I mean, this symmetry will appear as a local symmetry in the bulk. It will emerge, but you have to know that you have to look for it, right? I mean, a symmetry is there if you know how the symmetry acts on the Born indices. Right. So maybe it's a bit more complicated than that, because the action of the symmetry has only been defined on the physical indices, and you will have to tell me how the action acts on the Born indices after the optimization. We can discuss this later. It's a technicality. Question? Okay. So maybe I was just pointing out that this is possible, but this has been done. Work in this direction has been pioneered by Xiaoliang Qi, who said, okay, let's not just restrict to these isometries that we have, two legs into one, we could open them again, okay? So this was, when I described the meta as a quantum circuit, it was directly a map from the boundary to a product state, okay? So the meta was already able to do that, it's just that in condensed matter, that has not been explored at all. And Xiaoliang Qi, in the context of holography, has started to explore this possibility. So basically transform every isometry, every tensor with 2 to 1 legs into a unitary 2 to 2, and leave that leg open wherever it sits. So that's represented here, where each tensor now has an open leg as well. And so this gives you the degrees of freedom in the bulk. Okay. Very good. So lecture 3. It's okay that we don't have a lot of time left, because this was additional material in case we had time for it. So what I want to discuss now is something else. So far I've been looking at tensor networks as defining a variational ansatz, okay? So you have this huge Hilbert space, you don't know how to deal with it, you restrict your attention to some submanifold that you parameterize as a tensor network. Now I want to do something completely different. Okay? Now I don't want to use tensor networks to represent a variational wave function. I want to use tensor networks to represent something that can be exactly represented with a tensor network. And so what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be studying or considering the Euclidean path integral in 1+1 theories, or a statistical partition function in 2 dimensions. And in these cases, what we have is that both objects, there is some map between the two, a well-known map. And the idea is that both objects can be described in terms of 2-dimensional objects. So here in the Euclidean path integral, what we have is the direction. This direction is space, okay? And then we have Euclidean time going in another direction. Or in the case of a statistical partition function, we have 2 directions, Lx and Ly. And what I want to say is that it turns out that on lattice systems, such objects, the Euclidean path integral or the statistical partition function, can be naturally represented in an exact or quasi-exact way by means of a tensor network. Okay, so I insist this is not a variational ansatz. This is just a way of rewriting the Boltzmann weights or the exponential of the Hamiltonian in here. So to be more concrete, let me show you how this works. Say, let's take the Euclidean path integral. So that would be, let's take the IZ model, our favorite or the simplest system we can think of, directly at criticality. And so remember, this is a 1-dimensional Hamiltonian. You should imagine we have spins in one dimension. And it turns out that this is how we're going to produce this tensor network. We can always take this Hamiltonian, the exponential for a small time can be broken into, this is called the Trotter-Suzuki decomposition. You can break the exponential of minus a small time times a Hamiltonian as a product of two exponentials, where one implements this transformation on even links and the other one on odd links. Okay, so this is a well-known transformation that is applied all the time. So if you are not familiar with this, just take my word for it. But the idea is that we can take this exponential and break it as the multiplication of double rows of tensors. And so before you notice, you have this quantum circuit. But this is not a quantum circuit in the usual sense, because these gates are in Euclidean time. Okay, but this is a standard thing that is done. This is a representation of the exponential of minus beta h. Okay, for a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. And so this thing here is a quasi-exact representation of our evolution. And if we trace, you have a number of rows that is proportional to beta. It's a quasi-exact. So Suzuki Trotter expansion, in this Suzuki Trotter expansion, you make introduce an error that is the commutator is proportional to the commutator of the odd links. You break the Hamiltonian into odd links and even links, and then these two terms don't commute, and so there is a commutator to that. But it comes with, if there is a small time that you use, time step that you use, the error is tau squared instead of tau. And this is the simplest version. Then there are higher order expansions where this is going to, the error is going to be tau to the some power. Okay, but the important point is that this is completely standard. We are not introducing anything new. I'm just referring to it. And then what we're going to do is just cosmetics. We're going to take, say, this some of these tensors, as this one is going to be replaced with this one, which means we took the tensor and we broke it vertically through some singular value decomposition, your favorite way of breaking tensors. It's an exact transformation. So from here to here, it's exact. And then we just regroup, multiply indices, and we end up here. Okay. So the point I'm trying to make is that this is a quasi-exact representation of the Euclidean path, integral. Okay. And that's standard in the literature. This can be done. There is no new research going on here. Similarly, and this is maybe even more transparent, if you have the statistical partition function, in this case we have a two-dimensionalizing model, and well, you can imagine that you have spins on this square lattice, which I tilt for convenience. And so what we have is this Hamiltonian that says, well, if the two neighboring spins are aligned parallel, you have some energy. If they are, so you have one unit of energy. If they are antiparallel, you get minus one. Okay, and so what we're going to do is we're going to explicitly take the Boltzmann weight attached to that. So for instance, we have these four spins, spin I, J, K, and L. This is a classical system. Each spin takes values plus or minus one. And the Boltzmann weight between I and J is exponential of minus sigma I, sigma J divided by T. So I'm going to consider this Boltzmann weight times this Boltzmann weight times this Boltzmann weight times this Boltzmann weight, and that can be expressed in this way, and this is nothing but a tensor with four indices. Okay, so I can analytically write, if you give me the Hamiltonian for this two-dimensional classical system, I can analytically write this tensor representing the Boltzmann weights for it. So I do this everywhere in the system, and again I end up with a two-dimensional tensor network. Okay, so summary is that we have the tensor networks can be used to express, just, you know, you may not understand why I'm going to do this, but just believe me that you can do that, that you can obtain quasi-exact representations in this case, or even exact representations in that case of the Euclidean path integral or the statistical partition function. You could. That's just a particular way of doing it. Okay. In this particular way, it's even simpler to explain. If you did it in the other way, it's a bit, we would have to perform some transformations as we did on the other side. So that's the most transparent way I know of presenting this. Very good. So we have this. And now what we want to do So this thing here, maybe we have to trace the indices in both directions to get the partition function or the Euclidean path integral. But in the bulk, what we have is a tensor network that looks like this. And then what we want to do is we want to take, we can think of a cosine transformation on this partition function, okay? On this tensor network representing a partition function. And so we take blocks of four tensors and we group them together, and we can do this a few times. And so that's our goal now. It's to understand how to coarse-grain partition functions or Euclidean path integrals once we have expressed them in terms of this tensor network, okay? And so that's the setting, that's the goal, what we want to do. We want to define an RG flow in the space of tensor networks, right? And this is what, you can do this many times, and so on. And so here is the ugly slide. This is a proposal how to do this. And maybe the message that you want to take from this slide is that it's complicated, it has many steps, but let's not panic. I mean, you know, this is a complete sequence. There is a justification for these steps. I'm not able to explain them to you. I just want you to see what happens if you So what you want to see here is that you start with four tensors, and you introduce some auxiliary tensors that you actually these are disentanglers and they are isometries. So you know you are a bit familiar already with some of these guys, but there is a procedure to make replacements. So four tensors are replaced with this structure, and then this structure is broken in some way, and there are some more replacements, and eventually you go from four tensors A into a single tensor A prime, which is what we were after, okay? So that's a particular way of doing this coarse-graining. And now what we want to do is to see what happens when we apply this to our lattice. And again, it looks like a mess. There are two ways. That's true. So actually, maybe that's, yes. So what would, since I don't have time to review the literature, I don't have time to present what traditionally have been done, but what had been done traditionally is equivalent to this, except that you would set these disentanglers to be trivial to identity, okay? So what's new in this scheme compared to previous schemes is the use of these disentanglers here. And the point of introducing them is precisely the same as before. We want to remove short-range entanglement at each coarse-graining step. Okay? But I think that at the level I want to keep this discussion, it's much simpler than that. Just, you know, people do stuff, and the outcome is that we coarse-grain our tensor network into as we wanted. So we go from tensor A to tensor A prime. And now I want to show you what happens when you analyze when you iterate this procedure for, say, the Ising model, the two-dimensional Ising model. And so we're going to apply this procedure a number of times. And we'll start with some tensor A, and then we'll obtain a cosine tensor A prime, and A second, and so on. And then this will flow to some fixed point. So now, instead of talking about RG flow in the space of Hamiltonians or wave functions, I want to talk about an RG flow in the space of tensors, OK? So just to show you what type of things you find if you do this, what you see is, for instance, that if you start below a bit below the critical temperature. Now, here I'm going to plot a tensor. Now, what does it mean to plot a tensor? Well, just remember, we have four legs in these tensors, but we can join two and two, and that turns into a matrix, right? So after reshaping our tensor into a matrix, I can plot the elements. And so this would be, I think, a 16 times 16 matrix, maybe. Note. And white means large numbers. So I'm plotting the coefficients in this matrix, the entries of this matrix, and black means close to zero, and white means large. Okay, and you have all these colors in between. So what you see here is that as we coarse-grain the system, we have a look at the tensors that we obtain during the flow, and we see some tensor that is changing to some other tensor. And after a while, what we see is that we end up with a very, very simple tensor, okay, which has all components zero and only two components that are non-zero. Okay, and at this point, let me leave it at that. But we have seen that indeed we flow to a tensor. And actually, if I started with 0.8 times the critical temperature, if I change the temperature, as long as I'm below the critical temperature, I'll flow always to the same tensor. Maybe it will take more steps, less steps, but it's always to the same tensor. So as we would expect in a proper RG flow. Okay, at criticality, what we see instead is that this tensor, that if you look at the critical tensor, initially it's very similar to the non-critical one because we were very close to the temperature, to the critical temperature. So locally the system doesn't know whether it's a criticality or not. But as you coarse grain it, it stays the same. Okay, it's flowing, the flow is very simple, it quickly converges to something that doesn't change with the scale. And that's an approximate statement. This actually after 16 iterations, this is a numerical procedure, so you introduce errors, coarse graining errors, but it stays for many, many iterations. That's the statement that I can make. It's always infinite. So we have translation invariance, so a single tensor, you copy it infinitely many times, and that represents already the partition function or the Euclidean path integral, in this case partition function, on an infinite system, a two-dimensional system at infinite. Now, you need to coarse grain blocks of four tensors, and you have to do it infinitely many times, but you are always doing the same. A single tensor, see, yes, that's what I started saying, that this is, you take a single tensor and you turn it into a matrix, and now we plot the coefficients of this matrix. Okay? And we're studying, this is a local description of your system, and what we see is that even though initially the two systems at, say, temperature, critical temperature or slightly below, they look very similar, after some coarse graining steps, one converges into a fixed point and the other stays complicated also, so we have this non-trivial fixed point. Good. And so we also. Yes. Right. As I do in all these lectures, I skip the optimization step. But this optimization step is guided by. So the question we ask, the figure of merits that we have, is remember we had all the replacements. So this thing here, we replace it with that. But we will optimize these tensors such that this is as close as possible to this. Okay? So this tensor network here has 8 open indices, and this one has 8 open indices. So we're trying to make a local replacement of a tensor with 8 indices. It's small and it's extremely local. It's local in space and also in Euclidean time, so to say. Okay, so what I'm saying then is that even when you are above criticality, what you have is a flow starting from a tensor that looks, again, similar because we have only changed the temperature a little bit. It flows to another fixed point. And actually, you realize that this fixed point, which is very simple, it has only one non-zero element. The tensor has only one non-zero element. Is related to this one. This one is two copies of this. But that's what you expect, because what we have is that here we have an ordered fixed point, so symmetry breaking. So this fixed point is capturing all the spins up and all the spins down at the same time. Okay? Whereas this is the disordered fixed point, meaning that you only have spins in some orientation, which is actually up plus, well, in the classical system is no orientation at all. So what I'm saying is that this structure of fixed points, having a critical fixed point and two non-critical fixed points, is exactly as you would expect, as it is known to be the case if you use other schemes. Okay, but we are doing this in the space of tensors. Very good. So once we've checked that this coarse grain transformation acts as we would expect, so it defines a proper RG flow, we can start playing around, and that's what I'm going to do in the last 5 or 10 minutes.
I have a question about the previous
one. Sure.
Can you see the duality between
higher temperature and lower temperature? This duality is a non-local duality. is the Kramers-Vanier duality. And what we have here is a local, tensor networks are local descriptions, so you put together local tensors. And so they don't, we have not yet understood how to enforce non-local transformations on those. To make, so if we have, say, Z2 symmetry, it's acting on each tensor, we know how to incorporate that symmetry into the tensor to ensure that this symmetry is exactly represented. But with a duality transformation such as Kramers-Vanier, where you have this disorder of parameters going, well, it's a non-local transformation, then we don't know how to implement those. Yes. Good, so now what I want to say is that, well, let's play a game. So this coherent transformation on the tensor network, two-dimensional tensor network that represents a partition function or an Euclidean path integral, this coherent transformation, we don't have to, we've seen that it can implement global scale transformations, but when we work with it, we just modify the tensor network here and then there and then there. There is no need to implement a scale transformation everywhere in the tensor network. We could just implement a local scale transformation here and not elsewhere. So we're going to use that, this power, to investigate the possibility of applying local scale transformations on the lattice. And so the first example I'm going to show you is this one where you can take the Euclidean plane. This could be, the Euclidean plane, let's say. So, and then what we're going to do is we're going to introduce some puncture. This is just a way to visualize this. So we're going to just remove some tensors in the middle. So if you want, we have the punctured plane. And then we're going to apply the same coherent steps that we've been applying everywhere, except that because we have this puncture now, there are some tensors missing, and so we cannot apply the coherent transformation in the middle, okay? And if you do that, what you notice is that you can follow all the steps as usual, and tensors A will be mapped into tensors A prime, except everywhere, except near the origin, where you have this puncture, where you just have some leftovers that you can conveniently group in terms of some tensors, and so it looks like that, okay? So let me see what we've done here. We had a puncture, the puncture plane, we cosgrain it. We use this cosgrain transformation to cosgrain it, and we obtain what looks like the puncture plane again at at another length scale, so you can see, you can imagine all these tensors A prime are covering the whole plane, except near the origin where we have a layer of tensors that are different and then the puncture, okay? But as far as the A prime tensors are concerned, they form a tensor network which is identical to the original one, so we can apply the same cosgrain again. And so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to iterate this procedure. So I cosgrain once, I get this, I cosgrain twice, I get that, and I can keep going forever. And what you can see is that the net result is that we've gone from the plane with a puncture to something that, if you think about it, looks like a cylinder. So I'm going to take the inner legs here, and I'm going to put them down here. I'm going to take the outer legs here, and I'm going to put them up here. And you see that there are periodic boundary conditions in this direction. So this is a cylinder, okay? This is a discretization of a cylinder, okay? So that's actually what is used in radial quantization in CFT. We've just mapped the plane into a cylinder. And so if we use, for those who are used to that or want to relate to conformal transformations, that would be mapping the plane originally parameterized by Z, where Z is X plus IY, to map it into W, which is related to Z in this way. And so what we've done basically is the following. We've taken the plane, and we've coarse-grained it by an amount that is proportional to the distance to the origin, okay? We've coarse-grained the plane by an amount. See, if you are close to the origin, you just do a small coarse-graining transformation. If you, or one iteration, if you are far away, you've done, say, three or four coarse-graining transformations. And so in this way, we've obtained a lattice version of a conformal map. Very good, and why is this interesting? Well, one thing you can do now is to realize that once again, what we have here is a linear map that maps from one length scale to the next one. And so what you can do is you can diagonalize this map here. This linear map maps operators on one length scale into operators on the next one. And if you diagonalize this map, you get that the eigenvectors are again scaling operators and the eigenvalues are scaling dimensions. And so you apply this, say, to the 2D classicalizing model, and you get not only a lattice realization of the scaling operators, but their scaling dimensions, conformal towers, and so on. Good. So let me check time. I started at 5. Do I have 5 minutes, or do? Oh, and perfect. Excellent. Good. So then we have, what have we done so far? I have pointed out that you can rewrite the Euclidean path integral or the partition function in terms of a tensor network, and we have introduced a coarsening transformation that allows us to manipulate this Euclidean path integral or a statistical partition function. And now I want to keep playing with these tools. So the next thing I want to do is now I'm going to focus on Euclidean path integral, which I said I can write in this way. And now what I want to do is I want to this clearly is the trace of an Euclidean time evolution. So I want to consider the Euclidean time evolution on different geometries. I don't have to start with the plane. I can start with something else. So for instance, if I start with a geometry which is just the upper half plane, this is a representation of the ground state of your system, okay? This is just saying I'm going to evolve in Euclidean time for infinite time. That projects into the ground state. So from the start, if we put the tensor network in the upper half plane, we'll have a representation of the ground state. And then we'll apply coarsening transformations. Or I could also consider my Euclidean path, the Euclidean time evolution on a strip, of finite width beta. Well, this is going to give you a thermal state, okay? That's a thermal state for your quantum system. That is standard. I'm not using tensor networks here. I'm just telling you what happens if you consider the exponential of minus beta h. That's the thermal state. No. A thermal state is an operator between the Hilbert space and on the Hilbert space, right? So we have, this would be the brand, this would be the ket. It's a linear map in the Hilbert space. If I identify, I get the thermal, I get the Euclidean path integral again. Now I'm not taking the trace. That's the only thing I'm doing with respect to before, compared to before. Before I was identifying this with that. Now I'm not going to identify it. I'm going to leave it open. Okay? Okay, so I'm just recalling known facts that if you take the Euclidean time evolution for long time enough, you get a projector onto the ground state. If you stop at finite beta, then you get a thermal state. Similarly, if you take the same object and you put it on a semi-infinite cylinder with finite, which is finite in this direction, say size L, then what we would get is a ground state for a spin chain with periodic boundary conditions. Or if we put finite temperature, finite length in this direction, then we will get a thermal state on this finite geometry as well. Okay, so this is well known. But what I want to do now is, I want to represent this Euclidean path integral with this square tensor network, and I want to coarse grain it and see what happens. Okay, so let me do the first case, the first example first. I want to consider the upper half plane. And here's what I'm going to do. This is the tensor network on the upper half plane. So by an arrow, I mean that this continues all the way to infinite, and also this and this. But in this direction, we have an open boundary. Okay? So we've placed this tensor network, this square tensor network, on the upper half plane. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply this crazy sequence of small steps to it. And this time, what's going to happen is that nothing the same as before will take place away from the boundary. So I will go from tensor A to tensor, every four tensors A will become a tensor A prime. But again, at the boundary, I have open indices, so I cannot touch those, right? I cannot coarse grain tensors there. There are tensors that are missing here. And so what happens if you do that is that there is There are a number of cancellations, for instance, in here. To go from this step to this step, we have the this is U and this is U dagger, so it disappears. But at the boundary, there is no U dagger. Okay, so I cannot make it disappear. So this was a disentangler that, so at the boundary, we have a row of disentanglers that cannot be made to disappear. And later on, this is an isometry that disappears everywhere except at the boundary again. So what we end up with is the following. We end up with, we've gone from the tensor network on the upper half plane into a new tensor network also on the upper half plane plus a row of disentanglers and isometries. As if this is a row, or it's a cosine transformation as we have in the meta. So if we iterate this, right, I've described in detail how to go from the upper half plane to here. And what we saw was that we had this row of disentanglers and isometries that appear. Now I can further cosgrain the blue guys. I'll cosgrain them again. And a new row of disentanglers and isometries will appear. And if I keep doing that, what do I get? I get a meta. Okay? So remember that this was the ground state already. From the beginning, this was a quasi-exact representation of the ground state. And what I've done is I've cosgrained this tensor network in such a way that I've transformed this tensor. I've transformed this representation of the ground state into a new representation of the ground state, which happens to be a meta. Okay? So this is like going back one lecture, but it's not exactly the same. So we have seen the tensor network renormalization. By cosgraining this tensor network, we produce a meta. But this is different from what we did before. In the first lecture, or the second lecture, what we were talking about is the meta was a variational ansatz. Here's my favorite variational ansatz. Now go and for a Hamiltonian, try to optimize the variational parameters, and maybe you'll succeed and get a good approximation to the ground state. Okay? But this was through an optimization process. We have a variational class, and we try to optimize the parameters. What we're doing now is very different. Here, we have just recovered meta as a byproduct of some transformation. It's not a variational ansatz. Okay? It's not that somebody proposed, let's do this. No, this is the outcome of a transformation. What we had from the beginning was the ground state. And we've seen that by applying certain transformations to this tensor network for the ground state, we've obtained the meta. So this meta, if this transformation has been successful, if all these approximations that we have been introducing locally were proper, so they always introduce some error, if this error is small enough, we can guarantee that the final object is a ground state. It's a good approximation to the ground state. Okay? Because we.
On the right, how do you see that it's better for CFTs?
For CFTs?
On the left, it was clear that you had an argument that MPS is good for mass theory, meta was good for scaling.
So all this argument had nothing to do with how we would optimize the tensors, how we would choose the content of the tensors. So it also applies here, right? If you had a gap theory, what's going to happen is that when you reach the length scale attached to this finite correlation length, that your tensor network will become trivial. Instead of tensors, your partition function is going to be a product of numbers with no indices connecting them anymore. That's right. Yes. No, but what I mean here is that I don't have a variational class of states. I have just transformed the ground state that was represented with this tensor network into a mirror representation of the same ground state. So in here, let me show this. So here, in energy minimization, there are some computational issues. I will complain that we had to iterate many times, whatever, right? So there are local minima. There are all these things that you have to deal with when you do an energy minimization. But the important thing is that in the end, you get some optimized wave function, and you don't know if it corresponds to the ground state. You don't know, OK? So because we could extract good scaling dimensions from it and so on, we thought, OK, that's a good approximation. But we don't have any concrete, we cannot prove that it's a good approximation. Here, we started with the ground state, right? We didn't have to explore a space of parameters. We started with the ground state, and we just transform it into a tensor network. And if in this transformation, if we can quantify how many we can quantify the errors introduced in this transformation, and so we can, at the end, guarantee that we have the true ground state up to those errors. Okay? Good. And so that was one example of what we could do. And then the other example is, let's consider instead of putting this tensor network in the upper half plane, let's put it on a finite strip, so on a strip of width beta, and this could be infinite. And then when we apply the same coarse-grained transformation, what we realize, and now I don't show you anymore, but I claim that when we apply the coarse-grained transformation, we get again a row of disentangled isometries at this boundary, but of course we also get another one up here, okay? For the same reasons, for exactly the same reasons. And then we can coarse-grain again. And in this time, because beta is finite, we will stop after log beta times. Okay? And now what I want you to remember is that this is a representation of a thermal state. So since this is a representation of a thermal state, this is also a representation of a thermal state, and that's a mirror representation of a finite of a thermal state. And then all this holographic discussion, we could repeat the holographic. So if we were applying this to a CFT with a gravity dual, what we have obtained is a tensor network representation that relates to a black hole. And so if this was a Penrose diagram, where we have, and that relates directly to Juan's colloquium yesterday, this would be the past singularity, the future singularity. Time goes in this direction. Remember, for us, time is fixed. So what we're going to be talking about is, oh, sorry. Then as you go, going in this direction is related to scale. So we have two asymptotic CFTs on the boundaries, and moving in this direction corresponds to change of a scale in the CFT. And then what we're going to talk about is at fixed time, we're going to get a description. So you want to imagine that this thing here comes out of the screen, okay? It's a fixed time. And so what we have is that this is representing a time slice of this geometry. And in particular, so that would be, we have a black hole. These tensors in the middle, the tensors that we have in the middle, are what connect the left and the right asymptotic CFTs, okay? And so Rob, who might not be here, Rob Myers forced me into, oh, hi, Rob. Rob forced me into saying that that was the Einstein-Rosen bridge. Did I get it right? Okay, and yes. And so for those of you who are into holography, I'm sure that you buy it. Very good. So there are like 1 minute left, so this is the last piece I wanted to explain. So let me summarize these three lectures on tensor networks. In lecture one, we talk about tensor networks and many-body entanglement. And the many-body entanglement part of this was to understand how entanglement scales in ground states of one-dimensional systems. And we saw that for gap systems, we had the constant scaling. And for gapless systems, there was this logarithmic growth. And then in that same lecture, we talked about matrix product state, which was aiming at matching this constant growth, and then we talked about the mirror, which was aiming at matching this logarithmic growth. We've talked today a bit about mirror in relation to holography, and the last piece that we've seen is this tensor network renormalization, where in particular one thing that I just discussed is that it produces a mirror as a result. Okay, so this is an active area of research. There are many people contributing to it, and you know, As students, you may, if you are interested, there are lots of things to be done in this direction. Thanks. Can you get the microphone, please?
The fundamental step of transforming the tensor This complicated slide, no, the first one where you went from A to A prime.
The one that got you, huh?
I just wanted to ask, because it looked like you have so many tensors.
Yes.
No. Maybe even before.
Oh, that's through the one.
Just with a single.
No, this is. Oh, this?
Yeah, this one, yeah.
Okay.
So when you. So you, don't you have much more freedom in the tensors than in the starting point? Is it really. I'm confused, why is it a variational thing? Because I can fix U and V and so on such that it is true, no? I just choose them
okay,
to be
the
identity
point is
or
this
whatever.
One. The key point is this one. Here you have two indices, one and two. Here you take the two indices and you force them to match into a single index. So this is taking chi times chi levels into just chi levels. Here's where you're going to make a choice, okay? And so later you re-expand because this has to be approximate. So the later part is undoing what you just did. But there is a compression going on here. You take two indices into one. And so what you want to do, this is as taking two spins into one. And before you do that, there are two spins here, two spins there, okay? These are, so you could think of this as having, this is describing in some sense a state of eight spins. And you want to take these two spins together, these two spins together, these two spins together, and these two spins together. And before you do that, you're gonna let them, you're gonna let this spin and this spin interact through this unitary transformation. So that's where you're going to remove entanglement before you cross grain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there is a step where you only have four external legs.
That's right. Okay. And if you look at it, of course you have to replace this with that, but when you do it in this context, so here we just take four spins and we replace them with all this mess, but later on there will be cancellations of this step that you undid. You do the cross graining. Here we do the cross graining, then we undo it, but this undoing will cancel with the block on top, and so the net result is that we are cross graining the tensor network.
Okay, thanks. So and the other question is, when we start putting boundaries, it becomes a little bit less local, this transformation, right? Because we have to cross grain close to the boundary and far from the boundary, or not?
It's always local.
Because, for example, the dimensions of the indices are different, as we saw yesterday, right? Close to the boundary, they need to be close to the physical space.
Okay.
But far away, they can be very big and so on.
I think that's not an important point. So you could always start by grouping together several tensors so that effectively, so without any disentanglers or anything, so that effectively the local dimension has grown to your satisfaction, right? So instead of considering, so for instance here, I could go and put these four tensors together and define A prime directly as the product of those, where this index here is the product of these two indices. So okay. With no cross graining in the middle. So I will go from one dimension two to four. I iterate 16 and so on.
Yes.
Microphone.
So going back to the second to last slide, when you add two boundaries, with the tensor network normalization, and the question,
two boundaries.
Is did you have to contract that tensor network symmetrically from each boundary? Like, could you introduce asymmetry in the two CFTs? Did you have to, the way that you set that up, there's the same number of coarse grain steps from the top and the bottom, but what's preventing you, did you have to do that, or is there anything preventing you from introducing asymmetry?
There is a lot of freedom here, but in the end what we wanted to see was how to properly use META to represent the thermal state. There had been proposals in the literature where they were missing precisely this row in here, and so we just wanted to know what the right way of having a thermal state representation, meta representation was, and that was the game here. So you have a lot of freedom. You can apply these cross grain transformations however you want. Now the point also is not just drawing stuff, but from here we don't know how to efficiently compute expectation values. From here we know how to efficiently compute expectation values. All the discussion that we had. Remember that this is a two-dimensional tensor network. This is So we don't know how to efficiently compute anything. This is instead a meta for which we describe how to efficiently compute observables. So you can try to constrain this in other ways. The question, the important question will be, the net result will be some tensor network. Can you efficiently extract information from it?
Can you comment a bit about like numerical considerations here? Like, I don't know, how big are your tensors? How efficient is this?
So this happens to be more efficient than the variational optimization, the energy optimization, by a lot. And so, for instance, the scaling in one dimension in some scheme in Mera used to be through energy minimization was one dimension to the ninth power in some particular scheme. The equivalent scheme now is one dimension to the sixth power, which is a significant improvement. But also, you don't have to, so variationally, when you try to optimize your tensors to minimize the energy, you have to sweep scales lots of times. You have to go through all the system and make sure that all the tensors are as good as they could be, given the last changes you've introduced around them. Here, you just have to sweep over scale once. So you constrain your partition function or Euclidean path integral only once per scale. You just flow in scale once and you are done. Okay? So this means that algorithms are much faster, more robust, and with an outcome that can be certified. So we are very excited about this. And maybe maybe now it's the right time to jump to larger space dimensions. So with this alternative way of finding a mirror, now we feel that it might be the right time to attack two-dimensional systems.
ADS mirror correspondence. Can you interpret an area of a closed surface in the bulk in terms of mirror?
Can you say that again?
Can you interpret the area of a closed surface in the bulk in terms of mirror quantity?
The area of a closed surface in the bulk.
The same way as you interpret the Ryu Takayanagi as the area of the Ryu Takayanagi surface as a
right.
As an entanglement entropy, but now I'm interested in
I don't know exactly how I would do that. But your question reminds me of something that I maybe should have stressed, which is related to what you're asking, which is, let's see, where is holography? Oops, sorry. This is not holo. So if you want to think of the mirror as a discretization of the hyperbolic plane, which was the original proposal, then you may think that you go into the bulk, you cut a piece of bulk, you count the indices that you have, and that should give you measure the volume that you encircle. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
but naively that would
I don't know what will happen. I don't know what will happen there. Mm-hmm. In the sense that you are ignoring the causal structure of the mirror. You are ignoring the fact that these tensors have been optimized in a given way so that they are isometric. The right comment, though, sorry. So I want to refer to this work by Bartacek and others. What they are saying is that the tensors in the mirror should not be interpreted as representing pieces of the bulk of the hyperbolic plane, but actually you should think of that what we are discretizing is not the hyperbolic plane itself, but the dual space that you obtain by considering the geodesics of the hyperbolic plane. And so they are arguing in these terms, and they have a number of points that they make that I think are valid, and the issue is not settled, but it is possible that what we have to do is to think of the meta as a discretization of this dual space of geodesics in the hyperbolic plane. And this one point that they make, which is completely valid, is that in this dual space, you naturally recover the causal structure of the mirror. So in that dual space, you have that one geodesic, you have a partial order that says one geodesic defines an interval at the boundary that may be included in the interval of another geodesic. So there is a partial order between geodesics, and that gives you this Lorentzian causal structure.